Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Thridi Amgar, and we are going to be talking about The Museum of Failures, which is a Book Reporter Betzon selection, just as her last book, Honor, was. And that was also a Reese pick. Our Book Reporter reviewer, Catherine Weissman, had this to say about the book. The Museum of Failures is instructive as well as moving, as she captures the anguish of people torn between two worlds. Her own writing takes on a cinematic brilliance, evoking the imperfect earth of the city that Remy once loved and then left. It's a poignant journey with an ending that's better than Remy could have imagined or dreamed of, though different from what he expected. So that's what we're saying about the book. Welcome, Thridi. It's so great to see you again.
Well, wonderful to be here, Carol. And thank you for this wonderful review. That means a great deal to me.
We were really excited. Catherine really enjoyed the book. So can you give us a little overview, just your pitch about the Museum of Failures, how you would share it with us?
Sure. So it basically tells a fairly simple story about a very successful Indian-American businessman from Columbus, Ohio. He owns his own business. He has a very happy marriage to an American woman. And when the novel opens, he returns to India, which is to the city of Bombay in India, where he was born and raised. And the reason for the visit is to adopt a child that somebody that he knows is a teenage mom is giving up for adoption. But he still has, his mom still lives in India. And we find out very quickly that he has a very conflicted relationship with his mother. He always has. He's more or less in touch with her, but for the most part, they are estranged. Father has died, his beloved father has died 3 years earlier. So he goes to visit his mom while he's there, obviously, and finds out that she's actually in the hospital. So the story sort of makes one of several turns in that it now becomes a story of, rather than him becoming a father, which is still in the works, you know, now he has to step up to being the son that he actually has never been to his mother. So he nurses her back to health. And when he finally brings her home, he stumbles upon a family secret, which yet again makes Remy Wadia, that's his name. It makes Remy really sort of rethink everything that he's held to be true and dear, and reevaluate huge sections of his life. I would say that's what the book is about.
Exactly. And it's, you see Remy come home as one person and leave as somebody else because of what happens in the middle. And it's absolutely fascinating to see his development as a person besides what you're seeing with the other characters, throughout the book. Every book's got this moment of inspiration, sometimes more than one. Was there one that was really the catalyst for this book?
Very much so, actually. And it was another work of art. It was a movie. I think it came out in 2019 called The Farewell. And in some strange way, it is also a movie about immigration. It stars this Chinese-American woman who goes back to China to visit her mom. And there's a very devastating scene at the end of the movie where she and her parents are saying goodbye to the old lady, pretty much sure that they'll never see her again. You know, the grandmother lives in China and they are leaving for the airport. And man, there was just something about that scene that it was like a dagger through my heart. And of course, it's because I'm an immigrant and I've had family that I've had to leave behind in India. And it just resonated with me. And I walked out of the theater. I remember walking out of this darkened theater, must have gone to an earlier show because it was still light outside and sort of blinking in the sunlight. And right then and there, I thought, this feeling that I'm feeling, it has to find expression in some form. And I had no idea what form or shape that would take at that moment. I didn't have a character. I didn't have a plot. But I carried that feeling out of the theater with me. And a couple of years later, I think it took shape. as this book.
Wow. So along the way, if you walked out of the theater, did you take any notes of your emotion, or was the emotion so much in you from there?
Yeah.
You didn't have to do that.
I don't need to take notes of my emotions. I carry them within me. So yeah. No, and I knew, and just one more thing about that moment, you know, so this was 2019, and we all know the whole mm-hmm. debate about illegal immigration mm-hmm. that had really gripped the country, you know, building the wall, all of that. And so that was also very much on my mind, right? And when I finally conceived the character of Remy, who's this wildly successful, you know, well-to-do, educated guy, right? Who has come to this country with all the privileges one can imagine, right? I just thought, if Remy himself still feels this tug within himself, if he still has the sense of divided self, you know, what would it be like for people who cross the border with nothing but the clothes on their backs mm-hmm. and perhaps have no opportunity to ever return home? You know, mm-hmm. no economic opportunities to go home. Who knows what the state of their families, what world they have left behind, right? So that was something very important to me too, to talk about. You know, the only form of immigration that I know, which is legal immigration, but hoping against hope that somebody reading this book, it would soften their hearts a little bit so that maybe they could extrapolate from that and understand what a genuinely weighty, you know, immigration or migration in some ways is sort of the story of human history, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It is, in that sense, it's one of the most universal stories that humankind knows and tells itself. And yet it is also so deeply singular and personal, mm-hmm. you know,
true.
It's unique to every person who has left home behind, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated with these notions of what is home, you know, what is it? Is it just the people? Is it the land? Like, I love thinking about those things. So some of all of that makes it into this book.
And, you know, it's very interesting because our housekeeper, her son's wife is still in Guatemala. He is an American citizen. She is waiting to come. She has done all the paperwork. They have a baby. She cannot come because most of the people coming in right now are from Venezuela and from Ukraine. And that is the priority of bringing people in. And every other thing is backburnered. And it's very interesting to hear everything has been filed. The lawyers have done everything they're supposed to do. But now we've got two other global crises, and that's where our attention is. And it's just fascinating to hear about it, you know?
And it's not just because of that. It's not. Even in normal times, I mean, the weights, you know, so all these people who say, I have no problem with people coming into this country legally. You know, mm-hmm. I just don't want anybody sneaking in.
Right.
They don't know what they're talking about, Carol.
Right, right.
Because waits for legal immigration are, there's such a backlog that most people will like give up before it actually happens, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just amazing. A little compassion. I mean, I understand that this is a complicated dilemma that we face as a nation,
mm-hmm.
but I can't help but think that just a little compassion would go a long ways.
Right. And we're also thinking about two countries that are being taken care of. Is there a better way to do this so it's more equal of what's coming in, the people who are coming in, not what's people who are coming in? I don't know. The title of the book comes up throughout the book. And I love that because I'm always looking for, oh, where's the kernel of the title? First of all, there was a real museum of failures in Sweden. So how did you come across this?
I just came across an article. I don't remember if it was in the Times or something, but this was years and years ago. It was a delightful article about this museum that at that time still existed. It has since closed, which is itself a kind of delicious irony that I really relish, you know. It was apparently a brick and mortar store or museum that had like failed inventions, failed products, you know, and of course the assumption being that one, I'm assuming this was the assumption that one learns as much from failure as one does from success, right? But I just read, and it's the actual museum was called the Museum of Failure, you know, singular. Mm-hmm. My book is Failures.
Right.
But I read that and I immediately thought, that's it. that's going, someday I'm going to write a book with this title. It was just irresistible. And then for 3 or 4 years, I would look around thinking, God, I hope no other writer came across the same article and had the same thought process, you know? So luckily for me, I think I beat the rest of the pack to the punch. So, so when I conceived of Remy and his really his love-hate relationship with the city of his birth, Bombay, I just thought it acted as a beautiful metaphor for how he felt about the city.
I hope New Coke was in that museum. Talk about a failure. And you know, it's one of those ones that marketers always refer to as, is this good or is it New Coke? You know, is this good?
Exactly. Yeah, you know? Exactly.
So there's a chance for Remy and his wife, Kathy, to adopt a Parsi baby. And what is very special about this is it's a smaller group. And I believe your part of your heritage is part Parsi as well. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that and why this is such a small population of people. I think I saw 100,000. Am I right?
That might be an optimistic count at this point. I mean, the latest figures I've seen put it anywhere between 40,000 and 100,000. Parsis are practitioners of an ancient faith called Zoroastrianism, which originated in the Middle East. In fact, a lot of religious scholars would tell you that the three major religions that we know now that came out of that region all have their origins in Zoroastrianism. Mm. It was the state religion of the Persian Empire, which at one point, you know, was the biggest, largest empire in the world. This is all, you know, millennia back, right? What we are talking about. But about 1,000 years ago, my ancestors came from Persia to India, from mostly what we would today call Iran, right? So before when the Arab conquests of Iran or Persia occurred, many of them converted to Islam, the local people, but some refused to. And a handful of those people basically came by boat, by ships, to the western shores of India and requested asylum. You know, that's how we would refer to them today. And there's a beautiful legend about that encounter with the local Hindu king, which I actually wrote a children's picture book about called Sugar and Milk that retells and recasts that story. It's a lovely story. I won't bore you with it at the moment. But basically, the Hindu king allowed them in. And there was a promise made by this leader of this expedition. He was a priest who basically said, if you let us in, not only will we live among you in peace, but we will actually sweeten the lives of the people around us. And that promise of sweetening the life of people around you was something that the Parsis have really, really lived up to.
Hmm.
You know, Freddie Mercury, of Queen was a Zoroastrian, Zubin Mehta, Homi Baba. I mean, all these names that are kind of household names, Roynton Mistry, the novelist, right? So it's a very, very small community, but it has really been fundamental, I would say, to the building of modern India.
Hmm.
Certainly the city of Bombay itself.
You know, one of the questions I was going to be talking to you about is how much Remy is surprised that people in the United States don't know anything about these world cultures. And the way our geography is taught and the way the world is taught is so completely different. And he is surprised that there's no knowledge of things that he's talking about that he thinks should be known on a greater scale. When my younger son was in eighth grade, he had a fabulous, fabulous teacher. And she said, put the book down. We're not going to do the book. If we do the book, we'll get up to World War II. And a lot has happened since then. And he did brilliantly in her class, except for the one quarter that she was out for replacement hip surgery. And she says, I don't know what happened to Corey. She said, but I wasn't there. And he goes, oh, the other stuff was so boring. We had to do the textbook. She goes, we'll do some extra credit. But she really gave them a worldview. And we realized that we are so US-centric of what's going on. And it's only what's happening to us. It's not what's happening in a part of the world that may have nothing to do with us. And Remy brings up at one point that he's so surprised that that's what happens in America. And I should take it you see the same thing, because it's a, this is all we know.
Well, I mean, when I was a teenager in India, we used to joke. Now, this is me growing up in the 70s, you know, when Star Wars and all that was huge, right? We used to go around, we were smart, Alex, you know, a bunch of us, and we would go around saying, yeah, Americans know more about outer space than they know about other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could say that after I came here, I realized I was totally wrong and it was a bad joke to make. But if anything, I realized just that, you know what generation that I used to encounter when I first came here in the early 80s that knew a lot about geography? It was men who had served in World War II.
Interesting, right.
Because they were posted, they were based in bases all around the world. You know, they would talk to me about Burma and, you know, places that I'd never been to, but they knew a little something about geography. But like people, and I came here to go to grad school, right? So these were people supposedly with an education, my classmates, not a clue, not a clue.
I also thought understanding about each other's religions, usually around 13, people are bar mitzvah, they're confirmed if they're in the Christian faith. I don't know what happens in other faiths, but I said, what if we spent the year they were 14 going to the other churches, going to the other places of worship and getting to see what that was like and see what those religions were and how they practiced. And I said, it's not a hard thing to do, but to make that, like, let's look at curriculum. That's the 14 year, like, you know, thing you do. And you do it with, there's six things you go do or something. And I just think that, I think I thought about that like after 9/11, because there was a fabulous seminar that Abraham was the same in all three religions in Islamic.
Right.
And we went one night and Jane Friedman from HarperCollins had organized an evening with an imam, minister and a priest. And it was a fascinating evening. And it's one of those things you don't forget because you were taken outside of your comfort zone. You were in. Thinking much more broadly at the end of the evening. And I feel like more of that happening, even hearing about people across the border, hearing about, you know, what happens. My son had gone to Mexico on business and it was very fraught with, you're going with a guard, you're going with this and that. And he says, you learn a lot when you go to these places and you see what's going on.
Right.
And he says, when you're firsthand, you have a different take than reading, just doing this.
I think if there was enough wealth in this country, I think every U.S. citizen should be asked or offered help to travel, because there is no better ambassador for global understanding than travel. You know?
Right. And this is what's going to happen.
Eight people. It's interesting you said we are veering away, but
we'll come back. We always do.
You know, I'm teaching one of the classes I'm teaching this semester is about the literary response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the first book that I start with is called The 9/11 Report, which is just a graphic novel version of the actual, you know, the 9/11 Commission report. There's a line in that towards the end, one panel that says, in the end, they understood us better than we understood them. Right? This is like the narrative voice. So it must be part of the findings that that how did they knew all the fault lines. Just like in the 2016 election with the Russian disinformation and all that. They knew the fault lines of race, right? So that's where they went, right? So This is the price that one pays for not thinking of oneself, and when I say one, I mean nationwide, as part of a planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are so used to thinking of ourselves as a country that we sometimes forget that we belong to the same planet. Look at climate change.
Right.
You know? It's not, you know, the climate is not going to say, oh, Bangladesh had nothing to do with carbon emissions, so let's spare no, it's going to affect all of us. It is affecting all of us. I mean, Carol, you know, I keep reading these surveys that say that, believe it or not, Cleveland, Ohio is one of the safest places to be because we have a Great Lake, so we have an endless supply of fresh water, and we have been immune to tornadoes and earthquakes and, you know, all those things. Well, guess what? We couldn't go out for at least 2 weeks this summer because of the smoke from the Canadian wildfires.
Right.
Yes. No one is immune to what is happening, you know?
No, and I remember that night I was in New York. I went in for an event, and I rarely go into the city, but it was the 100th anniversary of Norton, so I went in. Right. And you were just driving. And the interesting thing was there were a lot of tourists there just walking around. And I was like, do you understand this is like really bad right now? This is not what you should be breathing. Yeah. And the way the whole place turned yellow in the afternoon. But it's interesting because, yes, there are all kinds of issues. And everybody ticks off a box, makes a donation, makes a this and that. But owning like what happens in the world, opening your eyes, which is what I think you really do with your books, is give us this view. And I'm going to talk about some of the scenes in it. That there was one particular one that I just was smiling at the same time. But coming back, let's go here. That Remy's mother is 70, and that doesn't feel old here in the United States. Is the lifespan shorter in India? Because I'm like, whoa, 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 70, whoa, 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 you know?
Yeah. So that was interesting. And to be honest with you, I struggled with that a lot. I wanted to make her a lot older, but I didn't know how to do that without making Remy older. Right. And because Remy is there to adopt a child, you know, he kind of had to be in his 30s somewhere, right? So part of that is just, I was constrained by the dictates of the plot, so to speak. So of course the life expectancy amongst Indians is much lower than it is over here. It's a poorer country. But the Parsis, for reasons I don't understand, and I don't think anybody understands, have ridiculously high life expectancies. I mean, Parsis routinely live into their 90s, routinely, right? So that's right. It's because when the doctor says, you know, your mom is an elderly person, and Remy's like, what nonsense? She's not that old. He's speaking not just as an American, but presumably because he also knows that, you know, most Parsis, 70 is like, they're like spring chickens at that age. And Parsis have the most horrific diets you can imagine, right? Everything has to be topped with an egg.
Yes.
Animal fat, you know, you can't eat a vegetable unless, I'm not like that, but most of them are. You can't eat a vegetable unless it has meat in it of some kind, right?
Right.
So everything that a cardiologist would tell you not to do, Parsis do. And they outlive everyone else.
Yeah. Well, so, it was really interesting because I was listening to the meals that they were making and I was like, whoa, whoa, cholesterol die. Whoa.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because you are reading about the foods throughout. You know, Remy has asked some family members to watch over his mother in exchange for their getting an apartment in a good neighborhood that they probably could not afford. And he arrives at the realize they've abused this privilege that he has, you know, put on their shoulders and not given his mother the care they need. And she's been just as tough with them, though, as she is with him. And she's a very difficult woman. This is not somebody. And is their role, like, really to point out how difficult his mother is? I felt like their role in the book at this point is like, it's not just you. She's like this with everyone. And then he has to have some come to, like, you know, figure out what I'm going to do because I'm going to leave her in their hands. She's either got to change or I've got to, like, you know, maybe give them something else to try to sweeten the deal or stay more on top of them. Am I right there? Because we're seeing she's just a difficult person.
So I don't think that Remy necessarily needs his cousin to point out to him how difficult his mother is. I mean, he's seen her in action, not just with him, but the way she used to interact with his father, you know. She's routinely fired servants. I mean, she has the reputation in the community of being a difficult person. He has, in fact, told his cousins this, you know, when he's making the arrangements with them for her care while he's away. But he feels a sense of betrayal because he feels as if he has given them ample notice and warning about what they're dealing with and who they're dealing with. But despite all that, you know, what he has promised them in return is so huge. Right. I mean, really, you know, Bombay is like Manhattan. Housing prices are off the charts, right? And in a neighborhood like Breach Candy, they would never have been able to afford that on their own. So he still expects something back in exchange for this. And when he realizes that they have treated her very dismissively, because they are human and they don't like the way she has dealt with them. He's angry at them. And then he's angry at himself because that, you know, that guilt sort of arises in him. And he thinks, well, what did I expect? I've sort of passed on my responsibilities, my obligations as a son to really virtual strangers. I mean, it's his cousin, but they have not been close, you know?
Right.
So it's this combination of resentment at them, but also feeling a sense of guilt.
Right. That's like, can you just call me when she's in the hospital? Like, don't call me when she yells at you, but how about when she goes to the hospital? Why don't we give a list of things? I feel like he's at the point where, well, what has to happen? Does she die before you say something to me?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
Why was I not told? So, yeah. You know, early in the book, Cyrus, Remy's dad, says, you only have two jobs in life, to be happy and make others happy. And let's talk about that, because it says so much about his father, that he wanted a perfect life. He wanted everything to be just shiny and perfect and wonderful, and them to be perceived that way as well. Even with his wife, you know, to be perceived like that. So I think it's just so much to be happy and make others happy. Great line.
Yeah. I think especially for his son. I mean, Cyrus is madly in love with his son, mm-hmm. right? And he is willing to do anything and pay any price himself to ensure his son's happiness, including from behind the scenes, sort of almost manipulating things so that Remy feels like he's programmed to leave. Mm-hmm. You know, he's programmed to leave India and build a life for himself. Cyrus encourages his decision to get out of India, and he also encourages and supports his decision to stay once he meets Kathy and wants to marry her. Mm-hmm. Shirin, of course, the mother, feels exactly the opposite. She wants her son with her to be back home. There's a line in the book that says something like, you know, this is the father, Cyrus, talking, saying, I never raised you to be a pigeon-chested Indian boy. I raised you to be a confident, you know, American boy. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, that's pretty radical, you know, mm-hmm. that he was thinking of his, you know, what would be the best place for his son? And he's willing to sacrifice his own happiness mm-hmm. for the sake of his son.
Yeah. And it's even like there's one day where he says his mother's clearly distraught. And when you hear the other things that are going on, you realize all the things she could be distraught. And he says, let's go to the zoo. What would you like to do today? I want to go to the zoo. I want to go see the elephants. My friend told me the elephants spewed water, and it's a fabulous day. And his father brings him back, and it's like, oh, it's just to be happy, just to be everything going on in life. And I just think it's a wonderful attitude to have, but at what cost? At what cost in the big scheme of things? Because he becomes the hero while the mother becomes the villain just about every single step of the way. So,
right.
So then Remy finds this letter for his dad that was meant for him, and he doesn't understand it when he sees it. Did you always want the family secret to be divulged on this note that he quite kind of doesn't understand? Like, there has to be a way, because his father's gone, to learn this family secret. And I feel like this cryptic kind of a thing that you may come across, was that always how you were going to present? Like, what's going on here, really?
Yeah, that was just a bit of foreshadowing, if you will. I just wanted people to know that, I wanted people, frankly, to keep reading, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the initial chapters, almost by definition, were kind of a little slow, because all it is Remy spending time with the would-be mother of the child that he hopes to adopt, and sitting endless hours in the hospital trying to interact with a woman who has fallen silent, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I needed there to be some mystery, some sense of drama with that note. And if a reader was, you know, paying attention, I think their attention would snag on that and say, what's that about? And I hope I find out what that note was meant to say as time goes by, and keep reading, because ultimately, this is what I say to my writing students, right? Ultimately, you have one job. You want the reader to turn the page.
Yes. Keep reading. Keep going, reading. Folks. That's what you need to do. Keep reading. I agree. So you see that. So you've got this little clue, and he has this line also, there's no room for hope in the museum of failures. The museum of failures comes up so many times. Even if it hangs on the wall for a moment, it usually comes crashing down. And I just love that. Like, hope can't really exist when you start constantly thinking about failure. You have to just sit there and say, things are going to go wrong. Nothing is going to go right.
Well, see, so Remy is definitely jaundiced about the city of his birth, and its projection is what it is. I mean, it's mostly because of his lifelong conflict with his mom, conflict that he simply doesn't understand. He's carrying a lot of pain and a lot of hurt from Shirin's treatment of him from the time he was pretty young, you know, and that has colored his entire view of his childhood and consequently the city in which he spent that childhood, you know. So I would caution you, I would just say, take everything that Remy says in the early chapters of the book with a pinch of salt.
That's exactly, And, but he's also, and it segues right into this, crowded streets are so common in India. And I love the image of the family of five on one motorcycle that where one child is standing in front of his father, the two children riding pillions squished in front of their mother. And imagery like that, I feel, gives your story so much depth, because you can sit there and say the street is crowded, but when you realize an image like this of the family perched on the one motorcycle, you've done something like that to give us a little snapshot of what's really happening on the street right then.
It's interesting. You call it imagery and I call it description. You know, I mean, you see that a lot in Bombay. You see entire families on these little, sometimes on scooters, you know, just those two-wheel scooters, because that's all they can afford. You know, they can't afford to buy a car.
Yeah, I just thought it was something that it just, you can talk about it's crowded. You can talk about, you know, what's happening. But when you do that, when you talk about the people walking down the street and he stops and there's somebody and they say, oh, your mom helped me somewhere along, or your dad helped me somewhere along the way. You realize, as big as it is, there's also this, you know, personal thing that's going back and forth where many people are still interacting with one another. It's not like this whole city where it's just people walking around. No, There are many, many relationships. Oh. I feel like you do a great job of setting up the big and the small at the same time. We see the vastness, but how people really do connect.
And that really is, that big and small is a great description of the city of Bombay itself. You know, for being, I mean, I have throughout my life here compared Bombay to New York, to Manhattan specifically. There's, I won't go into all of that, but there's a lot of, you know, they're both small islands that are really overcrowded with people. And, you know, there's that big city vibe to both places, all of that. I think one major difference, though, is Bombay in some ways still feels small and connected and intimate in ways that other big cities perhaps don't. And what I mean by that is, you know, let's say you're in a fender bender in Bombay. By the time you finish blinking, there'll be a crowd of minimum 30 people around you. Right. And they're not just standing there to gawk. If you need help, they'll help you. Wow. You know, that sense of, I don't know what to call it, community, or it's just a very matter of fact thing that people in Bombay do. And, you know, as somebody who grew up wealthy, middle class, let's just say, in that city, this is one of the reasons I personally can never give up on that city, because I see that kind of sweetness amongst the common people, you know, amongst people who may not have 2 cents to rub together, but that graciousness, that willingness to help, you know, during the monsoons when the city streets get flooded, people will rescue each other out of stranded trains, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, whereas here it's like on the news and it's those people, not me. That's them, not me. It's maybe you picture yourself, but not really. You know, it's on the flip side of thing, Remy thinks of his wife and he realizes meeting her had been rich and deep and transforming. And watching him re-enter India, back to Bombay, he realizes how different their lives are. And so he's really like this dual person. Her family is warm and embraces him. His mother is cold and his father's gone. And the first half, he feels like an orphan. I feel like he feels like an orphan. Whereas he realizes if he went back there, he'd be part of a big family. Is that a wrong thing to feel like he's like an orphan trying to help this woman that he's so estranged from, that he has an obligation to?
No, I think that's actually a very good reading of the text. I think I hadn't thought of it, to be honest with you, but I think, yeah, Remy does feel orphaned because for all practical purposes, he's a little afraid of his mom. The reason he warms up to her in the hospital is because she has mysteriously stopped communicating with people. She has literally stopped speaking. And she's lost a lot of weight. She's vulnerable now. He's no longer he doesn't she's powerless. She no longer has the power to hurt him. And I think this is all just early childhood stuff that he's still holding on to. And once he realizes, once the fear is gone, there's a vacuum there, and he can fill that vacuum with love. Right? The love has always been present. It's been present with both of them. As we find out, Shirin loves him madly,
Yes.
and he too loves his mother, but he cannot express that love because the fear is too great. She can be so cutting and so dismissive with him that he guards himself against her.
Yeah, it's and he's reluctant though also to take up some of the traditions now that are expected when you're there, including his mother's maid to perform simple household chores for him. Doesn't want that to be happening. He's surprised at how Americanized he's become and what's going on. And he has a lot of guilt, and he think he's surprised at how much has changed. And that's when I was thinking about your book, The Space Between Us, which I still think about. And I feel like living without this constant household support has influenced him more than he realizes when he sits down there. And I was thinking of The Space Between Us, of the way that there was definitely a hierarchy. She had the woman had a maid, or the housekeeper had a special cup. She couldn't sit on the same level with the other woman. It was such a fascinating book, but I feel like he right now is almost seeing a woman as being equal to him, because at home he would never allow someone to take his shirts like she's doing and wipe
Absolutely.
every cup as he drinks it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's very Americanized, and he finds these traditions absolutely appalling, which is exactly what they are. He thinks of himself as this young, able-bodied guy. He sees no reason on earth why he cannot pick up his dirty plate and take it to the sink, why someone has to do that for him, right?
Somebody's got to
So.
do this stuff all along the way. And Remy's got two different views, two different remembrances of his mom. The first one is he remembers as a child watching the sun go down, and his mother soothes him by saying it'll be back the next day. And he realizes then, this great line, that sorrow is in proportion to the happiness he felt earlier. Sadness equals, if I'm this happy, I've got to be this sad later. You can only miss what you value. There's so many great lines in this book, everybody. I was literally doing this as I was going. I feel like that's one of the big themes in this book, is you can only miss what you value. And it's like was something that I thought, did you give a lot of thought to that? Because where he's going is he's missing Bombay. So he has this feeling for it. He's missing his mom in a lot of ways. So it's price that feeling, positive or negative, it's feeling that comes out.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe I stand by that line. I think loss and love almost go hand in hand. I mean, you're not going to mourn the loss of something that you didn't treasure and value in the first place. It seems to me, I mean, it doesn't even feel like a, it feels very obvious. I mean, I feel like that's a fact.
But the way you express it there, the way from he's seeing it from a child's point of view, I just was just so brilliant. And then the book is divided into book one and book two. There's like this dividing line that comes in. And you're like, why book two now? What's going to happen? And then you start to realize that the blinders are coming off for Remy. He's going to start to understand more. Was it always going to be a book one and a book two, or as the editing process happened, did that end up, saying there's a line?
I don't remember. I don't
No.
remember. I'm guessing it was probably just in the writing of it. I don't outline my books, Carol.
You don't.
So I don't. I just
Okay.
write, chapter by chapter. Sometimes if I'm very impatient, I'll write the ending first and then, go back to chapter 12, just to get it out of my system. If I know the shape of the book, then I might do that. But I have, there's a pretty, once Shirin leaves the hospital, you sort of stop And then you inhale again, and then you exhale, and that becomes a whole new chapter, mm-hmm. And a whole new sort of passage in the book. Things change when he finally succeeds in bringing her home. So it just felt like a good point to just everybody settle in, take a breath. Here we start again.
Here we start again with the other side of the story, the other side of what's gone on.
Yeah.
And we don't want to give anything away. Did you always know what the reveal was going to be? Did you always know?
I mean, pretty much. I knew something had to happen. And initially I had, you know, just some very pedestrian ideas, mm-hmm. which for a minute there, I thought, yeah, that would be strong enough. And then I realized no, because what I was thinking of was so commonplace that it wouldn't have had the power to sort of rock Remy's world.
Right.
And I needed somebody to slap him and say, wake up, you know, think. And so it had to be a bigger thing than that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and sorry, you're both of us are talking around it, and I appreciate you not giving anything.
No, I don't want to give anything away. You know, Remy's mother would pinch him when he did something he didn't like. And this was very interesting. And at one point, as a child, he drops a butter dish on the ground and she whisks him away. And he says, pinch, mommy, pinch, because he's so used to this being the behavior. And he realizes she now realizes she's done that in the past. It's a big wake up and how he viewed it. And I feel like this moment between them makes them realize she needs a new way to interact with her son. She's got to do something else, whether she can or cannot. And I feel like the intent there was, oh my gosh, this is what I've done to this child all along. And now he feels that's a reflective behavior I should do on him, you know? Yeah. And I thought it was like right there, you crystallize, ooh, look what's going on with those two.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think that's an important scene. Where Shirin for the first time really sort of gets hit between the eyes and realizes what she has inflicted on and how she has already shaped his personality. You know, she's made him like this rather nervous, timid boy because of how volatile she is and how unpredictable her behavior is. I mean, I don't think Remy ever truly, even as an adult, doubts his mother's love for him, but it's that, you know, they say that that's the worst kind of abusive behavior, right? When it's pull and push. And I think Shirin, that is a wake up call for her. And she never does it again after that.
No, she realizes that's an expected thing. That's the wrong thing to do. It's just wrong. So little is talked about Kathy, the wife who's back in the States. And we only hear from her from conversations with Remy. Was there ever a thought to have sections about her sharing stories of Remy with her family and friends in the state, or to develop her more? Or because she's this character kind of off screen the whole way. Because it was a film, maybe we see her, maybe he's just on the phone with her.
Right.
Was there any, because it would be a much longer book, of course, you know?
Yeah. Not just a longer book, but it would be a gigantic detour. You know, for me, when I write, I literally say to myself, okay, what is the value added of this particular scene? Mm-hmm. You know, like if the main plot is the spine and everything else, I guess, are the ribs, you know, do we need that extra rib? Like what would it add? How does it strengthen the spine to have, sorry, I need to get away from this metaphor.
No, but it's one more. It's working.
Yeah. You know, and I can't think of anything really that Kathy would have brought to that. I mean, what we need to know about Kathy is there in the book. You know, Remy loves her very much. He's very happy with her. She has given him the stability and confidence that he's never had growing up. You know, and in the end, she too has a change of heart to some extent.
Yes.
The previous version of the book that I had read had Remy, Kathy and he have a child. So the adoption thing was not there at all. And that book ended with Kathy saying she and the daughter were getting on a plane to come see Remy in India. Uh-huh. So it was very different.
Very different story,
Yeah, but in this version, I didn't really see a great need to have Kathy there. I wanted this to be a book about a son and his mother.
And there's also Remy pondering that he and Kathy were open to adopting a Black child, but she wanted to have someone who looked like him in India, which was a very interesting for her to feel. And he does wonder if a white child was readily available. There are a lot of issues here to think about. What would they have done? Like, if they could have just done this. And I feel like you wanted readers to have a 360 view of creating a family and what would end up happening, because there were options for them. They could have tried this. They could have done that. And that she's saying, I really want you to have this piece of your country with you.
Right. Right. I think I also wanted to portray Remy as more than a two-dimensional, one-dimensional character. He has his prejudices and biases like everybody does. And I have him sort of almost chastising himself by saying, why didn't we adopt a Black child? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the latent prejudice within me that we never really seriously talked about that, you know? Mm-hmm. Because if they had done an adoption in the United States, chances are a Black baby or a child is what they would have been offered. And they don't go that path. Now, Kathy, I believe, does it with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. She loves Remy so much. She feels like she understands him so well that she thinks that having a child from India will connect him to his homeland and give him that sense of, you know, fatherhood. The paradox, of course, is Remy secretly, again, jaundiced by his horrible relationship with his mother, wants as little to do with India as possible. Mm-hmm. He even questions at one point whether there'll be any reason for him to keep visiting India once his mother is gone, right? He wants distance. And of course, adopting a child from India does exactly the opposite. It complicates his life. But again, he doesn't have it in him to just turn to his wife and say, no, sweetie, I don't think that's a good idea.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because he is that kind of a conflicted, slightly weak person.
Mm-hmm. We definitely see that as time goes on. Like, what's Remy going through? Remy's doing a whole metamorphosis while he's there. And he's remembering his father telling him in a note, because the only way to destroy the museum of failures is to burn every shameful secret that it ever held. And when people read the book, they're going to see the significance of that line, because you're going to see what unfolds that would make him say everything's got to come out in order for it to be like, you know, something different, for the failures to go away.
Yeah, I agree. And
I love the scene at the end with the kite flying. There's something magical about this scene. I'm not going to give it away, but why kites there? Because the kites to me, they said to me hope. And they also reminded me of the kite runner, where they were out and it's something childish that you do. You go out and fly a kite and automatically you become like a child again.
Right.
And it's a chance for Remy to just like let loose and become a child.
Well, you've kind of answered your own question, but also the sense of freedom, of liberation. You know, it's you and the kite under a sky, and it's flying, right? It's a form of flying. So I wanted the poor guy who I've tortured and twisted throughout the book to have some degree of catharsis. You know, at least a moment of genuine transcendence and freedom and fun. I just wanted him to have fun.
Yeah, it was great. It's a really great scene. And it's funny because a lot of this book I see as being like film running in my head. Like I could see the imagery so beautifully done of everything from the morning where he goes down to the beach and he just puts his feet in the water. There were so many scenes where you got to see the city. Even though I've never been to India, I felt like I was in that place. I was in what it was like to be in one of those high-rise buildings, what it was like for the smells on the streets and whatever. So, but that scene at the end really, encapsulated it all to me. It was just like, oh, I love it. So when you finish writing, who sees your work first? Is it your agent? Is it your editor? Who sees it?
In the past, it's always been this very dear friend of mine. And she read this book too. And she actually helped me with this version. As I just mentioned to you, I had a very different draft initially. And she talked me through, making it better. basically. So she was the first person who saw it after I implemented some of her suggestions and got done, which you know, I did in a matter of maybe 2 weeks, if that, once she read it. Then I sent it to my agent, who gave me pages and pages of notes, something that I've always craved and wanted, you know, for my work. And she was just fabulous. One of the things she told me was to elongate the ending. You know, I had this tendency as a writer, it drives my readers crazy, of just cutting off a book, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, wait, what? I want to know more, right? And she convinced me that that was not a good thing to do with this particular book, and that I should maybe add another chapter. And
okay.
That became the chapter that we just talked about. And then, of course, my editor saw it. And honestly, by the time I was done following Gail, my agent's suggestions, the book was in pretty good shape. You know, so there were no real problems with the editing of it.
She's total pro. And when you sit with a total pro, it's like, wait, how about this? How about that? And taking the time to do that. And before it gets to the editor, because I think that I've talked to a number of authors recently, and they said, you know, the editor gets one good pass at it, like looking at it. And then from there, if there's too much work to be done, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be making all those changes at that point is really, really rough.
And they'll pass on it, right? I mean, why shouldn't they? Because they have, you know, there's no dearth of wonderful books being written and produced and passing by their desk every single day, you know?
It's just wonderful. So the title, I take it, was always The Museum of Failures. Am I right?
Always. Yeah.
Always. Okay. So we didn't change that at all.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the cover. I just was sure that my galley is so beaten up. I was reading it in the pool over vacation. I got all my folded down pages. And I think I've told you in the past, there's some where the water hit.
That's great.
We have this thing that like Polaris, who runs around and it spits water. And I'm like, great, in the galley. Really nice. All those pages. But I fold down pages. And I think I've told you this in the past. And I don't say why. And when I go back to like prepare for an interview, I just open to that page and say, what was on that page that I cared about? And do I still care about it at this moment to ask a question? And it's an interesting way to go through looking at a book instead.
So you don't mark it up.
No,
I just fold down
the page.
And you can normally remember why
I'll just see this and I'll see just book two. Can't really see this. Book two. I have a question. Why was there book two? I have a question. Is there going to be a book three? On certain pages, there's certain passages that at the beginning, I saw Museum of Failures was coming up a lot. And I kept folding down those pages at the very beginning so that we're really setting something up there. But I don't write down exactly what it is because I want to see later on if it still matters. Is it still a question or has it so completely been resolved? And or what I know now has completely made it not something that's of interest anymore. So let me see what we do. So I just fold down
the pages. Brilliant. That's a great, I do that too. I fold pages, but I usually pencil in, I'll put brackets around things. So that's a great technique.
There's times where on both pages, so you have to do this fancy little thing. You have to do origami on that page. But believe me, I'm standing in the pool. And people are joking that that's really what you did on your vacation. I said, yes, I stood, I put weights on my feet, I exercised, and I turned the pages of the book. Oh, and a lot of them have water on it.
Wow.
But it was wonderful because the one thing that I loved was I could devour a book. I can usually read a book a day, honestly, but it's just sitting in there and getting as opposed to reading 20 pages here, 20 pages there or whatever. Yeah. So I feel like that's the way many people read, but I feel like to do an interview, you almost have to have that whole breath quickly because that's what you're going to get out of speaking with the author as well. So the cover has got, we've got type, we've got flowers. What do we have here? What's going on besides me seeing flowers and hope?
I think there are some thorns too, because they're supposed to be roses.
Let me
look at my own copy.
Yes, they're thorns.
Yeah, and you see there are thorns going through the word failure. So failures. So I think it's a pretty well thought out cover. Of course, I can't take the slightest bit of credit for it because I had nothing to do with it. But and the font that they've used, if you recall, Carol, is the same font that they used last year for Honor.
Honor, yes,
and
exactly.
So it gives you that sense of continuity, although, of course, it's different characters, different. It's a different story altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think they did a beautiful job. But Algonquin is sort of known for its beautiful jackets anyway, so.
You know, we want to do an evening with our readers, with a couple of cover designers coming on and talking about how they do covers, because it's such a big part of what's going to interest you in reading a book when you're in a store, if you have never heard about the book. And to sit and see over my vacation, the other thing I did is I went to a local Barnes and Noble. We have a very small indie bookstore near here, very tiny. But I went to Barnes and Noble because I've heard they've redone, you know, what's going on. It was really interesting to go in and see a wall of books, because so many times when we're looking for an image online on a publisher's site, we're looking for an image here or there, but to see the whole wall and see the way books come to life.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, this will stand out and it'll stick out, which is important when you look at that whole wall, you know,
right.
going on. How about the audio? Do you have anything to do with the audio?
Yeah, I actually helped them. They gave me a choice of three or four readers. I loved the guy, Vikas, who we picked. He had read one of my favorite novels many, many years ago, Roynton Mystery's Fine Balance. He was the reader for that. He's a voice actor, but I think he's also an actor. So he did an audition, and the snippet that I heard was so fantastic. We were thinking, like, how are we going to do Shirin's voice, right? So will we hire a second female voice actor for that, etc.? He read her passages, you know, as part of conversation between her and Remy, so effectively. He just changed his voice ever so slightly, softened it a little bit, that I thought, I think he can pull it off. I think he can do all the multiple voices in this book. Mm-hmm. Like, now it's feeling like, you know, exaggerated or caricature, like he didn't do like some high-pitched voice. I mean, it was just very tastefully done. I think people who pick up the audio of this are in for a very pleasant surprise, because he's terrific.
Oh, that's terrific as well. So I get to ask you the line that, oh, God, really, Carol, at this moment, are you working on something new? Okay. I mean, this is really great. Honor was terrific. Everything's really good. But like, hey, what's next?
I'm trying to, you know, right now I've taken a bit of a sabbatical because I'm teaching full time and I'm promoting this book. So it would be a bridge too far. But I think starting next year, I'll be able to devote a lot of time and attention to it. I'm trying to write a kind of mystery novel with a twist. Mm-hmm. And that's new for me. So it's going to be a steep learning curve, but I'm excited. I know the characters. I know what happens in the book. I have probably over 100 pages written, which will all, you know, end up in the trash can at some point, and I'll start again. But so far, so good. There is momentum.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of books right now, they're big art thrillers, and there's that twist or what's going on. And when it's done magically, it's amazing. It's, you know, it takes you like to a completely different place. And
it's interesting, you know, my twist is not going to be like a major plot twist. Mm-hmm. It's just in the character development that I want to try something different than what has been done.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, we look forward to it. Have looked forward to every book you've done. So this is like really terrific. Thank you so much for joining us and being a part of this. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol. You're just a delight to talk to. You know that.
Keep listening for an audio excerpt, Museum of Failures by Thriti Ungar, narrated by Vikas Adam, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Hachette Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Museum of Failures, narrated by Vikas Adam, courtesy of Hachette Audio.
All night long, the crows fought as a jet-lagged Remy Wadia struggled to sleep in an unfamiliar bed. Occasionally, a dog howled, the sound hair-raisingly melancholy, and Remy had to cover his ears with a pillow. He heard the roar of a motorcycle and glanced at the alarm clock. 2 a.m. A few minutes later, he was on the threshold of a dream when loud voices from the street below jolted him awake. He swore under his breath, flinging the sheet off. Finally, at 6 a.m., even though he was afraid of awakening Django and Shanaz in the next room, he got up to use the attached bathroom. Then he made his way to the small balcony off his bedroom. A light breeze from the nearby sea made his thin muslin sadra flutter against his skin as he leaned against the railing. He looked down at the treetops. What had made the damn crows squawk all night long? There had been something spooky and unnerving about their nocturnal shrieking, but then this, too, was Bombay. The birds as defiant and absurd as the rest of the city. He looked toward the main road and wondered if his mother was awake too. Her apartment building was only a few streets away from Django's, where he had spent the night after his friend had picked him up from the airport. Remy yawned. It had been a long flight from Columbus, Ohio, and he was exhausted. Then he reminded himself of the reason for his visit to India and felt a throb of excitement. Shanaz's niece, Monaz, was to arrive at 10 a.m. He thought about taking a quick shower, but worried that the sound of running water would disturb his hosts. Still, he wanted to look his best when Monaz came, wanted no trace of his fatigue to show. First impressions are often the last impression, Dad used to say. Dad. The thought of his boisterous, warm-hearted father made Remy smile. It was his first time back since Cyrus had died 3 years ago. He had not visited his mother since then, and he felt the usual pang of guilt at the thought. Well, he would see her in a few hours, would surprise her by showing up at her door. Maybe things would be softer between them now that Daddy was gone and Remy no longer had to protect him from his mother's grievances and sharp barbs. A solitary crow rose from the tree and fluttered past the balcony. He'd hated them since his childhood, when one of them had swooped down and stolen the sandwich right out of his hand, its sharp beak slicing his finger. Remy rubbed his thumb against his index finger, tracing the path of the injury, which had faded to a faint scar. How old had he been on that Sunday at the zoo with his father? It had been a happy day, but bookended by disaster. His parents had planned a different excursion, but something had gone wrong. They had fought. Remy closed his eyes against the memory of the rumble of voices, as steady and incessant as rain, coming from his parents' bedroom. When at last his mother had emerged, her eyes were red. A wave of outrage had risen in the young Remy, and he'd run up to hug and console her, which was why he had been stunned when she'd gruffly pushed him away. Cyrus had come out of their bedroom in time to see Remy stumble, had noticed the tears that sprang into the boy's eyes. His face flamed.
Shame on you, Shirin, he said to Remy's mother. You're taking out your goodness against me on an innocent boy?
It was too late to stop the tumble of memories. His mother's grief turning into anger. Her accusing Remy of putting on a show for his father's benefit. Cyrus roaring with indignation. The look his mother threw at Remy before she locked herself in her room. Remy had crept away into his own bedroom, but a few minutes later, a grim-faced Cyrus stood in the doorway.
I'll be damned if I waste this beautiful day waiting for Shirin to come to her senses, he'd said. Where would you like to go?
Remy didn't have to think. The zoo, he said. A baby elephant had been born there a few weeks earlier. Django had gone last week and was still gushing about it.
Done, Cyrus said. Go put on your shoes and socks.